alliance with Saudi Arabia after the kingdom and its oil exporting allies agreed to a production cut ahead of the November midterm elections, which Democrats are already set to lose to the Republicans. In an interview on Sunday, October 9th, Morphy lambasted OPEC's cut of 2 million oil barrels per day and called the decades-long U.S.-Saudi partnership broken. Morphy said recently, "I don't have any problem with American presidents meeting with our friends or adversaries," adding, "I think it's clear that right now the relationship is broken, but it's been broken under Democratic presidents and Republican presidents." The OPEC's decision has prompted some lawmakers, including Morphy, to rethink Washington's alliance with Saudi Arabia, which routinely purchases American weapons and hosts troops. Morphy said, "We sell massive amounts of arms to the Saudis," adding, "I think we need to rethink those sales. I think we need to lift the exemption that we have given this OPEC cartel from U.S. price-fixing liability. I think we need to look at our true presence in West Asia and Saudi Arabia." Morphy noted, "For years, we have looked the other way as Saudi Arabia has chopped up journalists, has engaged in massive political repression for one reason. We wanted to know that when the chips were down, when there was a global crisis, that the Saudis would choose us instead of Russia." Morphy added, "Well, they didn't. They chose Russia."
Midstream.
Initial approvals of Lebanon and the occupying Israeli entity on the draft agreement on the demarcation of the maritime border between the two sides entered the stage of operational steps. This is a historic deal for both sides. The operational steps will include announcing an official position approving the agreement before embarking on executive steps related to the final drafting of the papers that must be signed by representatives of the two parties with the participation of the United States as a mediator and the United Nations, which then leads to announcing the validity of the agreement. To discuss this issue, with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament at the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Moussaoui. Now, we are currently in the eye of the storm of loud statements and contradicting positions concerning the success of the mediated maritime border demarcation negotiations. Which the highlight of this was a phone call between U.S. President Joe Biden and Lebanese President Michel Aoun and in Beirut, and the Prime Minister of the Israeli entity government in occupied Palestine, with congratulations and supporting for the success of these negotiations. In a simple question, who made this success possible?
Well, thank you for giving the opportunity first. And let me say that we are talking here about a combination of factors that came together and boiled down to this very important development in the economical or financial situation of Lebanon, though not in the short term. First and foremost, we have to thank the resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General, and all those who have been very cautious and continues to be cautious as well up till now, for their efforts in order to make this take place. Of course, we can talk about the unified position of the official Lebanese state. I mean, The state in Lebanon, the President Michel Aoun, the Speaker of the House, and the Premier, they all had one unified position, and this is very telling about the unification of the position of Lebanon, whether in this matter or in other matters. So here we are talking about the people, we are talking about the state, we are talking about the resistance. The resistance and the drones that were sent over Karish, they sent the alarming signal to the Israelis that you cannot extract the oil or the gas, you cannot explore or exploit without giving Lebanon the right to do so. So I would say that the reason for this, the cause of this, which we should all thank, is the combination of the factors which the resistance occupies the primary seat in it.
Well, Dr. Moussaoui, we did hear Secretary General of Hezbollah Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah stating after the announcement of the success of the negotiation, he stated, and I quote, "We in the resistance won't say that things are over until the delegation signed the document at Naqoura, that's South Lebanon." Meanwhile, he also warned his enemies that until the Lebanese people see the delegations going to Naqoura on TV, the resistance must remain cautious. Now, this is clearly a vigilant stance by His Eminence that lacks any trust to his enemies, as always. But what is he being watchful of at this specific phase in the negotiations?
Well, you know very well when Sayyid Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, talks, he presides over a long history of experiences with the Israeli enemy. We know this enemy in different instances. I mean, we have seen, we have learned, we have matured, we have the wisdom. And when I say this, I say it in the name of Sayyid Nasrallah, because he is the one who is leading all of this struggle, honorable struggle against the Israelis on all levels and on all fields. That's why what's he cautious, and he wants the Lebanese to be cautious, he wants the resistance fighters to be on high maximum alert, is that the Israelis can flop the whole position and they can, if you want, stab in the back. This is the nature of the enemy, the hostility and the hostile nature of the enemy. And this is the kind of things that they might do at any time. So because we are wise enough, as Lebanon, as Hezbollah, Sayyid Nasrallah has been telling the Israelis all of the time that you can never take us by surprise. And we are ready, we are vigilant, we are on high alert, and we will always be there for you if you try to do any deceiving for Lebanon.
Well, Dr. Ibrahim, we did see that we had lots of stances in Lebanon as well as in the Israeli entity in the media. We did see Benjamin Netanyahu claiming that this was a historic deal that snubbed the nose of Israel for the first time in comparison to other deals or other agreements made. This is the first time that Netanyahu thinks that Israel has bent down to Lebanon. How do you think this kind of statement will affect the internal Israeli entities community?
Well, this is a very important remark by you. I would say that it's very natural. The kind of expression that was used by Netanyahu about bowing to Hezbollah pressure and surrendering to Hezbollah, and that Israel has signed this agreement with the pistol in its head by Sayyid Nasrallah, we all heard that. But at the same time, the estimations and the assessment of the Israeli intelligence and military and security apparatuses, the three of them, they said this is very necessary to do. And they are responsible for it, not only the premier, the Israeli premier. The other things that we have to be very aware of is that the Israelis have always been exercising their hegemonic and their prejudice and if you want, their despotic nature all over the Arab and the Islamic world. When they come, there are rare times when they bowed down. Of course, they bowed down and they were brought to their knees by Hezbollah in the military confrontation. Now, with this deal, economic deal that has been reached to this kind of agreement, call it whatever you want, they have been brought down to their knees by Hezbollah on the economic level. When Hezbollah warned the Israelis and threatened them that Karish is going to be targeted if they are going to start to explore and exploit and extract the oil or gas and exclude Lebanon from having the right to do so. By this, we say that the Israelis have been brought again into their knees by Hezbollah, by the resistance in Lebanon, by the combination of these factors. But at the same time, the Israelis will not be able in any way to, like, say, surrender or go away from accepting the reality. This is a de facto situation that was imposed on them. Why? Because they cannot but to do it. Even Netanyahu himself, if he was the prime minister, he would have signed the agreement. This has been told to him. This is another surrender, and this is another testimony by the Israelis that they cannot by any way fight Hezbollah or stand to Hezbollah fight. Again, what's the alternative to the Israelis? The alternative would be a complete failure on the military level and on the economic level, because they want to invest the oil in the occupied territories.
Well, that is on the Israeli front, but what about the Lebanese front, where a lot of Hezbollah's foes are accusing the resistance of being part of some sort of a normalization, or that Lebanon has given up its rights, especially by giving up the Line 29 in Karish? How do you think such statements would affect the resistance inside of Lebanon?
Sayyid Nasrallah has been very clear yesterday during his speech. We're talking about only a few hours past this time. Sayyid Nasrallah said it, that we are behind and we support and we are in favor of the position of the state. If you want, he made it very clear when you talk about the 29, 23, 21, whatever the lines that they talk about the MBL maritime border line. We do not recognize all of this as a resistance. The thing is that the Lebanese official state has taken a position, and Hezbollah supports the state position. Those who are opposing, or those who say that Lebanon neglected its own rights, they should bring the alternative. I mean, you know, people make a lot of theories, but when it comes to the practical line, they would all fail to produce anything.
Well, the success of the maritime border demarcation negotiations, Dr. Moussaoui, opens the door to discussion about possible land border demarcation with the Israeli entity, despite the fact that it's occupying Palestinian land. And the Israelis has many times hinted about this matter, that they want this matter to happen. What is the official stance of Hezbollah on this matter, knowing that a lot of Hezbollah's force are using this pretext of land demarcation to demand the disarmament of the resistance, because they think that once the demarcation is done, there's no need for the arms?
It's not the matter of demarcation. It's not about demarcation. Hezbollah has never said that when the demarcation takes place, we're going to do this. There is a percept of a threat. The Israelis continue to violate our rights. They continue to violate our space. They continue to violate our land. We're talking about occupation. Mm-hmm. We have to remember always that the Israelis continue to occupy Shib'a farms and the hills of Kfar Shuba and other Lebanese villages. They continue to represent a threat to Lebanon on many different levels. That's why when we talk about the capability of Lebanon to defend itself, when we have a strong army that is empowered, that the Americans do not put a veto to arm it with enough and efficient equipments, military equipments, to stand for the Israeli threat, then the discussion could be started about it. So it's not only a matter of demarcation, the land demarcation. It's a matter of percept of threat. It's a matter of liberation of the occupied territories. And when we reach there, this would be another thing to be talked about.
Well, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament at the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.
And for explaining how this new success of negotiations has been historic for both sides, but at the same time that the resistance will remain cautious to whatever its enemy is hiding. I want to thank you for your time. Now, please stay tuned.
Pleasure.
Because next we have Sana'a preparing for confrontation in Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Ministream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Despite Sana'a's adherence to the issue of disbursing the salaries of all employees as a prelude to renewing the truce, the core of the rams between it and Riyadh may go beyond that stumbling block to the gains that the two sides can generally achieve. In light of the situation, the United Nations unsurprisingly leaned last week to the Saudi side by holding Ansarullah responsible for thwarting the agreement to extend the ceasefire. The latter continues to confirm and affirm its readiness for all scenarios, including targeting Saudi oil industries, amid indications that this grey period will not be for a long time before its outcomes become clear. Sana'a prepares for confrontation in this following report.
After it has been 6 years since the transfer of the central bank from Sana'a to Aden, watching the suffering of government employees in Yemen without lifting a finger and even with a recommendation to continue using this pressuring card in the face of Ansarullah, the United States suddenly became concerned for the payment of salaries owed to these employees. However, the changing international circumstances, which forced Washington to bow its head to the Yemeni storm without abandoning until now, along with its Saudi pawns, their attempts to circumvent the required understandings to attain a real peace treaty. While Sana'a is aware of the criticality of the American position, it wants to invest it to the fullest extent in achieving these demands related to lifting the siege, on top of which is the payment of pensions regarding which Ansarullah insisted upon. This was evident after Ansarullah sensed an effort to terminate the agreement in this regard. As a result, negotiations to extend the armistice failed, a failure that quickly necessitated mediations in which various parties, including Oman and Qatar, were involved in order to save the situation and prevent the collapse of a truce that the concerned parties seemed to have a great interest in achieving, led by Washington, Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, and even Doha. In light of these developments, the United Nations leaned last week to the Saudi side by holding Ansarullah responsible for thwarting the agreement to extend the ceasefire. The latter continues to confirm its readiness for all scenarios, including targeting the Saudi oil industries, amid indications that this grey period will not last before its consequences become clear. Day after day, the chances of saving the truce in Yemen are dwindling, amid increasing signs of a possible return to fighting. While the current state of truce and non-war between the expiration of the ceasefire period and a final decision regarding its renewal or the resumption of fighting is not likely to be prolonged. The issue of government employee salaries, which represented a major stumbling block to the extension of negotiations, may not in itself remain a reason for dropping the truce and its benefits. While Sana'a is ready for all scenarios, the other side, represented by the Presidential Council residing in Riyadh, continues to refuse to respond to an amended initiative proposed by the UN envoy to Yemen, Hans Grundberg, which includes agreeing to pay the salaries of military employees from the Ministries of Defense and Interior in areas under the control of Sana'a. The Presidential Council rejected the new UN proposals at the behest of Saudi Arabia, only agreeing to pay the salaries of government employees working in the civil sector exclusively from the resources of the Hudaydah port only, while describing those working in Yemeni government-controlled areas as Houthi fighters. However, Sana'a made it clear that refusing to disperse the salaries of 653,000 Yemeni government employees would mean the inevitable continuation of the war.
Well, to discuss this issue with us from Sydney is Dr. Jay Therapel, researcher, academic, and political commentator. Jay, thank you very much for being with us. But before we begin, I really would like to congratulate you, dear Jay, on achieving your PhD. I have followed your hard work throughout the years, and now all the hardships has paid well. You have left no stone unturned, Jay, throughout these years, and I want you to know that I'm extremely proud of your achievements.
Thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it. Yes, it has been difficult, but I got through it.
Oh, congratulations to you again. Well, Jay, it seems that we are at a nail-biting phase in Yemen. Do you think that Ansarullah will have to implement its threats against the oil refineries for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to make them agree on a new ceasefire?
The short answer is yes. The only way the Yemeni national resistance led by Ansarullah can force the Saudis to pay a price for imposing a siege on Yemen and for stealing Yemen's energy resources is by resuming its drone and ballistic missile operations that target the oil infrastructure of Saudi Arabia. But if those threats are implemented, then Saudi retaliation could actually increase the suffering of the Yemeni people. So we have to acknowledge that during this latest ceasefire from April to October, even though the Saudis only slightly relaxed the blockade, this did offer some relief for the Yemeni people. So according to the United Nations, civilian deaths fell by about 60% during this period, and Yemen was able to replenish its stocks of fuel. That being said, even though the Yemeni people have experienced some temporary relief over the course of the ceasefire, they're still under a siege by the Saudi-led coalition, and both the Saudis and the Emiratis continue to plunder Yemen's energy resources. So far, around $13 billion worth of Yemeni oil and gas has been exported from Yemen, according to Abdul Malik al-Ajri, who is on the negotiating team of the National Salvation Government in Sana'a. I raise this because the Yemeni resistance doesn't need to target oil facilities inside Saudi Arabia. Instead, it can choose to begin its escalation by targeting the theft of Yemen's own resources. Mm-hmm. Indeed, just last week, the government of the National Resistance in Sana'a, they issued an ultimatum against foreign companies that are involved in buying stolen oil from Yemen, that they will be targeted by the aerial capabilities of the resistance.
But Jay, we did hear the Presidential Council, which is basically being played by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, they rejected the new international proposals, which were brought in by the UN, which say that they have to pay for the 653,000 employees residing in Sana'a and the northern part of Yemen. But they still refuse. How do you think Ansarullah will solve this issue?
I'd like to talk a little bit about this. I mean, the stance of the Ansarullah-backed National Salvation Government in the capital, Sana'a, is that the so-called Presidential Council, and I say so-called, is that this council is ultimately responsible for paying the wages of Yemen's government employees because they have the means to do so. So according to Abdul Malik al-Ajri, who's from the negotiating delegation, as I mentioned before, the Saudi-led coalition, they control 80% of Yemen's oil and gas resources. So before the war began, these revenues were used to pay the employees who work in Yemen. And Yemen state employees, they comprise about 34% of the total workforce. That's according to another National Salvation Government official, Salim Mughallis. So also the so-called Saudi-backed Presidential Council, they have control over Yemen's central bank reserves, which were transferred to Aden back in 2016 under the former puppet president of Yemen, Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, who's based in Saudi Arabia, which is why I call him a puppet. So before 2016, government wages were paid from this central bank, but the National Salvation Government in Sana'a does not have those funds. These are entirely located in Saudi Arabia these days. So crude oil sales from Yemen are around $300 million per month. This does not go to 80% of Yemen's population who live under the National Salvation Government. And that's more than enough to cover the salaries of state employees all across Yemen. But the problem is that according to Ahmed Hajar, the deputy finance minister of the National Salvation Government, most of this is plundered and it's transferred to Saudi Arabia. So the pro-Saudi media has been claiming that the Ansarullah-backed government in the capital, Sana'a, is refusing to pay the salaries of state employees and instead spending that money on resisting Saudi aggression. So the strategy of the Saudi-backed puppet government is very clear and obvious here. They want to force the National Salvation Government to pay all the costs of the Yemeni public sector while they themselves plunder Yemen's natural resources. So to answer your question, according to Abdul Malik al-Ajri again, The Sana'a government is willing to pay the salaries of all government employees provided they are given control of the oil and gas resources of Yemen. So the Yemeni resistance, led by Ansarullah, is promising to resume military operations unless the puppet government repatriates Yemen's stolen financial reserves and lifts the blockade.
Wow, so basically the Presidential Council is just taking all the gains and profits from the resources, the oil and gas, and they are refusing to pay money and telling the rebels, go pay them yourselves. That's just a 101 cartel happening in Yemen. But the next confrontation is set by many observers that it will be an energy battle par excellence, knowing that Sana'a is ready to impose a new military equation in light of its growing military, air, and sea capabilities. But will Saudi Arabia, do you think, Saudi Arabia, will it risk everything that it has, given the ongoing huge demand for oil and gas in Europe? Will they just not give Ansarullah what they want and risk a new explosion in one of their Aramco refineries?
The problem for Yemen is that Saudi Arabia right now can actually afford to take a risk, precisely because oil prices are high. However, this also means that those of us who want to see this war end should be making the argument that ending the Saudi-led war on Yemen will actually put downward pressure on oil prices. The problem for the rest of the world is that Saudi Arabia does not have the ability or the capacity to increase production beyond around 10 or 11 million barrels per day. They really struggle to get more than around 10 million barrels per day, and they can only sustain that for about a month. And this is what the Saudis have been claiming that they're pumping out now. They're claiming to be pumping around 10 or 11 million barrels per day. And also, like, on top of that, OPEC Plus has agreed to cut production even further. The only reason oil prices appear to have stabilized over the past few months is because the U.S. is flooding the market with its strategic reserves, which have fallen to levels that haven't been seen since 1984. So if on top of this, the Yemeni resistance are able to inflict the kind of damage that we witnessed in September 2019 when the resistance attacked the Aramco facilities, then that could force the Saudis to drop oil production by, let's say, about a million barrels per day for around a month. So the question for Saudi Arabia is whether they care more about protecting the banking fortunes of these corrupt Yemeni officials who betrayed their country, or whether they care more about the safety of their oil infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So well, it remains to be seen. I'm pretty sure that the upcoming months up until the new year will be heavy everywhere on this planet, especially in the region of West Asia. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Jay Therapel, researcher, academic, and political commentator, for joining us to talk about this matter. Thank you. I hope that you found this episode to be an educating one, despite all the fake news that you're getting from, especially from the Western mainstream media, concerning our problems here in West Asia. Thank you very much, and I'll see you again next week. Fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today we complete explanation of Surah Mujadila, or the Pleader, which is number 58 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Medina and mentions the complaint of a woman whose husband had put her away by resorting to the pagan Arab formula known as Zahar, which consists of the words, "You are to me as the back of my mother." This was a pagan custom to imply a kind of divorce that freed the husband from any responsibility for conjugal duties as well as providing support for children, and without allowing the wife the freedom to leave the husband's home or to contract a second marriage. The woman, who along with her husband had become a Muslim, pleaded to the Prophet against this unjust behavior and said she also lacked the means to support her little children. Her prayer to Allah and her plea was accepted, and this brutal and unjust custom of the pagan Arabs was abolished through revelation of this surah, which goes on to state that those who oppose God and the Prophet or fall to the temptations of the Satan or lie in their oaths and make intrigues against the Prophet will be defeated and suffer humiliation both in this world and in the hereafter. While Hezbollah, or the party of Allah, which means those who have firm faith in God, will triumph. We start from where we left you last Friday in our last episode of this series, and here are ayahs 18 and 19 of the said surah.
يَوْمَ يَبْعَثُهُمُ اللَّهُ جَمِيعًا فَيَحْلِفُونَ لَهُ كَمَا يَحْلِفُونَ لَكُمْ وَيَحْسَبُونَ أَنَّهُمْ عَلَى شَيْءٍ أَلَا إِنَّهُمْ هُمُ الْكَاذِبُونَ استحوذ عليهم الشيطان فأنساهم ذكر الله أولئك حزب الشيطان ألا إن حزب الشيطان هم الخاسرون.
The day when Allah will raise them all together, they will swear to him just like they swear to you, O Prophet, supposing that they stand on something. Look, they are indeed liars. Satan has prevailed upon them, so he has caused them to forget the remembrance of Allah. They are Satan's confederates. Look, indeed it is Satan's confederates who are the losers. If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last week, we said the stratagem of the hypocrites is to undermine Islam by claiming to be Muslim in order to prevent the proper promotion in society of God's commandments. Of course, this is nothing but foolishness on the part of the hypocrites to think of themselves as clever and smart when their end is utter humiliation, both in the transient life of this world and in the hereafter. An important point to note is that wealth, power, and children may be of help in the world, but will be of no avail in the hereafter. The ayahs that we recited to you now mean to say that the hypocrites resort to false oath both while alive in this world and also when resurrected to life after death in the hereafter. Hypocrites are mistaken to think that they can save themselves from divine punishment through lying, since lying has turned into a natural disposition for them. The day of resurrection is the scene of manifestation of deeds and intentions, and even on this day, when shown their evil deeds at the final tribunal, the hypocrites will falsely swear in the same manner that they used to swear false oaths in the transient life of the mortal world. The next ayah says the hypocrites have allowed Satan to completely dominate them to the extent they have forgotten God Almighty and His blessings. They have become the confederates or party of the Satan whose deception has totally absorbed them. In other words, the more a person drifts away from God, the more he or she is entrapped by Satan. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, whoever heeds the temptations of the Satan will become a member of his party and thus become a loser in both the transient life of the mortal world and on the day of resurrection, where nothing can save him or her. And number two, if a person becomes a habitual liar, this habit of lying will continue even after resurrection on the day of judgment. Now let us listen to ayahs 20 and 21 of the same surah.
إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُحَادُّونَ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ أُولَئِكَ فِي الْأَذَلِّينَ كَتَبَ اللَّهُ لَأَغْلِبَنَّ أَنَا وَرُسُلِي إِنَّ اللَّهَ قَوِيٌّ عَزِيزٌ.
Indeed, those who oppose Allah and His Prophet, they will be among the most abased. Allah has ordained, surely I and my prophets will prevail. Indeed, Allah is all strong, almighty. Here it is stressed that the hypocrites and the disbelievers are the most abased people since they disobey the Almighty Creator's commands and ridicule the prophets. As Ayah 21 means to say, such persons will never succeed and victory belongs solely to God and His prophets, even if the enemies happen to temporarily silence the voice of the messengers of God through imprisonment and murder. These ayahs teach us that, number one, disbelief, denial of truth, and hypocrisy leads to self-destruction and permanent loss in afterlife. Number two, those who oppose the manifest truth are the most abased persons. And number three, the divine promise on the final triumph of truth over falsehood will materialize in the end times with the advent of the awaited savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance for establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. At the end of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, we complete explanation of Surah Mujadila. And here is the last ayah, that is 22, in which God Almighty says,
لَا تَجِدُ قَوْمًا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِاللَّهِ وَالْيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ وَادُّونَ مَنْ حَادَّ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ ولو كانوا آباءهم أو أبناءهم أو إخوانهم أو عشيرتهم أولئك كتب في قلوبهم الإيمان وأيدهم بروح منه ويدخلهم جنات تجري من تحتها الأنهار خالدين فيها رضي الله عنهم ورضوا عنه أولئك حزب الله ألا إن حزب الله هم المفلحون.
You will not find a people believing in Allah and the last day endearing those who oppose Allah and His Prophet, even though they were their own parents or children or brothers or kinsfolk. For such He has written faith in their hearts and strengthened them with a spirit from Him, and He will admit them into gardens with streams running in them, to remain in them forever. Allah is pleased with them, and they are pleased with Him. They are Hezbollah. Look, indeed the party of Allah is the felicitous. This ayah refers to a general principle, that is, the obedience to God Almighty through devotion to the prophets, imams, and saintly people, while firmly opposing the enemies of humanity. In other words, love for God and love for the enemies of humanity cannot be intermixed or assembled in one heart, even if the disbelievers happen to be the nearest of kin and blood relatives of the believers, such as parents, children, brothers, or sisters. Thus, God considers true believers whose hearts are purified with obedience solely for Him through devotion to the teachings of the prophets, imams, and saintly persons as Hezbollah or party of Allah. Such people are ensured of success in the world and in the hereafter through divine assistance, which becomes more manifest in the bliss of paradise where lush gardens and fresh flowing streams are granted to them. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, true faith requires obedience to God through devotion to the teachings of the prophets, imams, and saintly persons, while fully disavowing the disbelievers, even if they happen to be the nearest of kin. Number two, love and affection of the faithful and the faithless cannot exist in one single heart, which ought to be purified of all filth in order to gain the belief. And number three, in Islam, the bonds of faith are superior to family, tribal, and even national attachments.
Iranian
a senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran's current unrest follows several popular eruptions in recent months around the globe. These movements that have taken place in countries such as the United States, Canada, Haiti, Indonesia, Russia, and China, while powerful, have largely fallen short of making the kind of change that many protesters desired or was once the typical outcome. Mass protests like the recent ones in Iran, whose participants have cited separatist agenda, corruption, economic hardships, political participation and gender issues, were once considered such a powerful force that even the strongest governments might not have survived their rise. But their odds of success have seriously declined worldwide, the latest socio-political research finds. Factors appear to include polarization and social media influence and manipulation, among other things. In the past, activists had to spend months or years building the organizational structures and links necessary to launch a mass protest in the real world. This also made movements long-lasting, since they were supported by the infused discipline and order. But nowadays, social media allows potential protesters to bypass those steps, driving one another to action with as little as a viral post. This usually leads to rallies that bring thousands or millions of bodies to the street in a flash, but that often fade away just as quickly. Having said that, the flare-up around the country indicates that the fate of Iran's civil unrest is still hanging in the balance. To take a closer look at what's actually taking place on the ground, stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. Protests have been taking place in several Iranian cities over the September 16th death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman who died at hospital a few days after collapsing at a police station in the capital Tehran, where she and a group of others were receiving educational training on dress code rules. These recent protests, though challenging the country's government forcefully and in a number of ways, are today more likely to fail than they were at any other point since at least the 1930s, according to a data set managed by Harvard University researchers. The causes of this trend are still being debated, but experts have agreed on a few influencing forces that apparently impact this emerging situation, some of which can also be seen in Iran.
My theory is that instead of relying on a satellite channel, they're betting their hopes on Twitter and Instagram. And they think by making the issue a trend and publishing their favorite narratives as protests, they will be able to escalate the situation. On the other hand, in addition to their round-the-clock coverage, they are using bots to propel their campaign. But that's something we can do as well. It's not just a tool for them. So some of this movement could be generated by bots. Therefore, the protests that cannot be found on the streets are being retweeted by the same users over and over again, making them trends.
For instance, social media, which makes it possible for protesters to organize and gather in spectacular numbers, sometimes with little or no formal leadership, may also ironically undermine those uprisings, according to a theory suggested by a Columbia University sociologist.
If you switch over to opposition media, they keep talking about the public opinion in Iran. They keep spreading news about supposed public opinion in Iran, but in fact what they keep fixating on as public opinion is being handmade and formed by mainstream media. Public opinion is the sum of the discussions in a society, but they are trying to create this perception for the public by manipulating various people in the society. The same applies to online trolling campaigns. Manipulating public perception isn't something new, and it's been happening immediately after the revolution. The day after the revolution, opposition groups started publishing pamphlets and delivering them overnight to manipulate public perception. As we continued down our path, many anti-revolution media outlets were established that tried to manipulate the public as well. Later on, social media networks and platforms came to work, and now we see cyber services continue to manipulate public perception and thought. They use this tactic to manipulate people's opinion to the point that they create narratives entirely different than what's actually on the streets.
New research indicates that protest success is no longer related to the number of participants. Instead, the most important factor may be a movement's skill at persuading or negotiating with key power brokers in the country's political apparatus.
Remember that these users are mostly young people who are very emotional and passionate. That's why they violated some ethical etiquettes as well. These innovative violations are further escalating unethical tensions in the society and in the social media. But there are those who are able to guide this young generation through logic and guidance. If they find our arguments agreeable, they will certainly share it.
Protests were historically only one instrument in political campaigns to pressure governments, along with negotiation with political leaders and alliance building with influential figures. In contrast, the use of social media by driving popular attention and energy away from such organizational efforts means that mass protest is now often the only tool, and typically ineffective on its own and easily manipulated. The official medical report about the results of its investigation into the case of Mahsa Amini was released on October the 8th, some 3 weeks after the 22-year-old Iranian woman was pronounced dead at a Tehran hospital. Iran's forensic organization said she died from natural causes. It attributed her death to multiple organ failure caused by cerebral hypoxia or lack of oxygen to the brain. An underlying disease related to surgery she had when she was 8 had caused Amini to lose consciousness, the report said. A physical examination of the body and autopsy pathology test showed her death was not caused by blows to the head or any vital organs and parts of the body, according to the report.
Cracks in the skull can be detected in a physical examination in cases of severe skull fractures. There were no signs of violence on the head or the face of Mahsa Amini in the physical examination. There were no signs of skull fractures on the base of the skull or bruises around the eyes, or raccoon eyes, as the medical term goes. We didn't find any bleeding inside the ear, which could be caused by a broken petrous bone or fractures in the base of the skull in our autopsy. There were no signs of bleeding or hemorrhages in the dura mater, pia mater, or the subarachnoid area. We didn't find any signs of trauma and tissue damage in our examination of the brain and parenchyma tissue. All we detected was a 2x3 cm calcified mass, which was a result of her previous brain surgery in the supracellar area. In the overview of the brain, we can see an anasarca edema, which is expected in a patient who suffered from hypoxia and multiple organ failure.
Mahsa Amini's family claimed. In the past couple of weeks prior to the official coroner report, the Western media was insistent on fanning unsubstantiated claims about the case without waiting for the investigations to conclude. They were pushing a false narrative that the Islamic Republic is attempting to brush aside the issue.
In the 2009 conspiracy, they manipulated the public perception to make everyone think that the elections were fraudulent. As one of the leaders of the conspiracy said, the idea of fraudulent elections became the pulse of the riots back then, and it was a result of this media manipulation. Let's look at a more recent example. The issue of Miss Mahsa Amini was manipulation project condemned Gina or Mahsa. Even when she was still alive in the hospital, they talked about the beatings that she supposedly was subjected to and then created the narrative of a murder. The hospital hadn't released any records, but they talked about what she had gone through in the police station with no credible references. After the CCTV footage was released and the medical examiner reports came out and various medical experts made statements about the case, we realized just how intense the problem was and where they were leading the public opinion.
One of the mission objectives in Iran that is actively pursued by Mossad and CIA is creating fake killing scenarios, and it's an entirely tactical and security-sensitive project that's being directed and managed by Mossad, CIA, and MI6. It aims to pump up and escalate public hatred and anger, and it is a very common scenario that's played out in color revolution. It's a soft war tactic used by enemy intelligence services right now.
Journalists are trained to be fair and objective, to verify facts without fear or favor. But once again, the Western media agencies failed to adhere to the sacred values of ethical journalism in Amini's case.
In the first few days of the riots, heads of terrorist groups stated that Mahsa is an excuse, and we are aiming for the principles of the system. So they didn't care about finding out what the story was all about. If they did, they would wait for legal authorities to make a statement. Iran's forensic organization, which is the top medical authority, after a few weeks of research and assessment, has released a coherent technical report with observable reasons, but they aren't willing to recognize any official authority in the country and simply reject it.
Iranian officials believe that the story of recent riots is different from all previous examples, and the most important difference is the contribution and role of social media platforms driven by foreign adversaries. Cybersecurity reports show that social networks are in command of the violent clashes and vandalism on the streets of the Islamic Republic, and gone are the days when the media was only for information dissemination. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian denounced the rioters and what he called terrorists, whom he believes tried to hijack recent peaceful demonstrations across Iran in order to sow unrest throughout the country under the influence of some foreign states and amid instigation by foreign television channels. Such malpractice is unacceptable no matter where it takes place across the world, he asserted. The top Iranian diplomat also articulated that Tehran accords great primacy to women's rights. He noted how Iranian women play a very influential role across the country's various academic, scientific, medical, educational, administrative, and technological sectors. Tahan Nazif, spokesperson for the Constitutional Council, said what happened in recent weeks was more than a conventional protest. The Constitution recognizes demonstration as a legal form, but these days the protests turned into violent riots, in which the role of foreigners is also clearly visible. This is while the people did not join the destructive acts and separated their line from the rioters, to quote. Thus, the enemies could not achieve their goals. Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
As protests started in Iran, a fierce battle to control the narrative began to take shape online. Digital disinformation experts who analyzed pro and anti-Iranian government activity on Twitter suggest there may be coordinated manipulation campaigns at play. The hashtags associated with the protests show a striking number of new accounts created since the protests started. Most of the September accounts were created in around 10 days following Amini's death. It's quite rare to see this amount of new online mobilization of accounts that then subsequently and continuously engage in tweet activity. The creation of new accounts is a repeated hallmark of dis- and misinformation actors who participate in the conversation to push a narrative, said a cyber program scholar. So who's behind all the Twitter activity around hashtag Mahsa Amini?
Another report by the New York Times in 2018 about cyber trolls claimed that three separate networks are guiding these trolls. The first network operates out of the Pentagon and the U.S. Army, the second one is controlled by the Zionist regime, and the third network works for the Saudi Arabian Intelligence Service. These three networks are unanimously working on a project which Trump called the Maximum Pressure Campaign in 2018. According to one of the reports, the Tavana Institute, which produces this information, had received $1.5 million from the U.S. State Department to establish this online troll network against Iran.
There's plenty more, right after a quick diversion into world media. So stay tuned. Here's how it looks on the page. Fars News quotes the Iranian Foreign Ministry's spokesman, who said undeniably